Chapter 2. Casper. Macon. The well-known shrill voice startled Almayer from his dream of splendid future into the unpleasant realities of the present hour. An unpleasant voice too. He had heard it for many years, and with every year he liked it less. No matter, there would be an end to all this soon. He shuffled uneasily, but took no further notice of the call. Leaning with both his elbows on the balustrade of the veranda, he went on looking fixedly at the great river that flowed indifferent and hurried before his eyes. He liked to look at it about the time of sunset, perhaps because at that time the sinking sun would spread a glowing gold tinge on the waters of the Pantai, and Almayer's thoughts were often busy with gold. Gold he had failed to secure. Gold the others had secured dishonestly, of coarser gold he meant to secure yet, through his own honest exertions, for himself and Nina. He absorbed himself in his dream of wealth and power away from this coast, where he had dwelt for so many years, forgetting the bitterness of toil and strife in the vision of a great and splendid reward. They would live in Europe, he and his daughter. They would be rich and respected. Nobody would think of her mixed blood in the presence of her great beauty, and of his immense wealth. Witnessing her triumphs he would grow young again, he would forget the 25 years of heartbreaking struggle on this coast, where he felt like a prisoner. All this was nearly within his reach. Let only Dane return. And return soon he must in his own interest, for his own share. He was now more than a week late. Perhaps he would return tonight. Such were Almayer's thoughts as, standing on the veranda of his new, but already decaying house, that last failure of his life, he looked on the broad river. There was no tinge of gold on it this evening, for it had been swollen by the rains, and rolled an angry and muddy flood under his inattentive eyes, carrying small driftwood and big dead logs, and whole uprooted trees with branches and foliage, amongst which the water swirled and roared angrily. One of those drifting trees grounded on the shelving shore, just by the house, and Almayer, neglecting his dream, watched it with languid interest. The tree swung slowly round, amid the hiss and foam of the water, and soon getting free of the obstruction, began to move downstream again, rolling slowly over, raising upwards a long, denuded branch, like a hand lifted in mute appeal to heaven against the river's brutal and unnecessary violence. Almayer's interest in the fate of that tree increased rapidly. He leaned over to see if it would clear the low point below. It did. Then he drew back, thinking that now its course was free down to the sea, and he envied the lot of that inanimate thing now growing small and indistinct in the deepening darkness. As he lost sight of it altogether, he began to wonder how far out to sea it would drift. Would the current carry it north or south? South, probably, till it drifted in sight of Celebes, as far as Macassar, perhaps. Macassar. Almayer's quickened fancy distanced the tree on its imaginary voyage, but his memory lagging behind some 20 years or more in point of time saw a young and slim Almayer, clad all in white and modest-looking, landing from the Dutch mail boat on the moldy jetty of Macassar, coming to woo fortune in the godowns of old Hudig. It was an important epoch in his life, the beginning of a new existence for him. His father, a subordinate official employed in the botanical gardens of Buitenzorg, was no doubt delighted to place his son in such a firm. The young man himself too was nothing loth to leave the poisonous shores of Java, and the meager comforts of the parental bungalow, where the father grumbled all day at the stupidity of native gardeners, and the mother from the depths of her long easy chair bewailed the lost glories of Amsterdam, whereas he had been brought up, and of her position as the daughter of a cigar dealer there. Almayer had left his home with a light heart and a lighter pocket, speaking English well, and strong in arithmetic, ready to conquer the world, never doubting that he would. After those 20 years, standing in the close and stifling heat of a Bornean evening, he recalled with pleasurable regret the image of Hudik's lofty and cool warehouses with their long and straight avenues of gin cases and bales of Manchester goods, the big door swinging noiselessly, the dim light of the place, so delightful after the glare of the streets, the little railed-off spaces amongst piles of merchandise where the Chinese clerks, neat, cool, and sad-eyed, wrote rapidly and in silence amidst the din of the working gangs rolling casks, or shifting cases to a muttered song, ending with a desperate yell. At the upper end, facing the great door, there was a larger space railed off, well lighted. There the noise was subdued by distance, and above it rose the soft and continuous clink of silver guilders which other discreet Chinamen were counting and piling up under the supervision of Mr. Ving, the cashier, the genius presiding in the place, the right hand of the master. In that clear space Almayer worked at his table not far from a little green painted door, by which always stood a Malay in a red sash and turban, and whose hand, holding a small string dangling from above, moved up and down with the regularity of a machine. The string worked a punka on the other side of the green door, where the so-called private office was, and where old Hudik the master sat enthroned, holding noisy receptions. Sometimes the little door would fly open, disclosing to the outer world, through the bluish haze of tobacco smoke, a long table loaded with bottles of various shapes and tall water pitchers, rattan easy chairs occupied by noisy men in sprawling attitudes, while the master would put his head through, and, holding by the handle, would grunt confidentially to Vink, perhaps send an order thundering down the warehouse, or spy a hesitating stranger, and greet him with a friendly roar, "Welcome, Gapitan. Where you come from? Bali, eh? Got ponies? I vant ponies. Vant all you got. Ha, ha, ha. Go in." Then the stranger was dragged in a tempest of yells, the door was shut, and the usual noises refilled the place. The song of the workmen, the rumble of barrels, the scratch of rapid pens, while above all rose the musical chink of broad silver pieces streaming ceaselessly through the yellow fingers of the attentive Chinaman. At that time Macassar was teeming with life and commerce. It was the point in the islands where tended all those bold spirits who, fitting out schooners on the Australian coast, invaded the Malay archipelago in search of money and adventure. Bold, reckless, keen in business, not disinclined for a brush with the pirates that were to be found on many a coast as yet, making money fast, they used to have a general endeavour in the bay for purposes of trade and dissipation. The Dutch merchants called those men English peddlers. Some of them were undoubtedly gentlemen for whom that kind of life had a charm. Most were seamen. The acknowledged king of them all was Tom Lingard, he whom the Malays, honest or dishonest, quiet fishermen or desperate cutthroats, recognized as Hirajalat, the king of the sea. Almayer had heard of him, before he had been 3 days in Macassar, had heard the stories of his smart business transactions, his loves, and also of his desperate fights with the Sulu pirates, together with the romantic tale of some child a girl found in a piratical bra by the victorious Lingard, when, after a long contest, he boarded the craft, driving the crew overboard. This girl, it was generally known, Lingard had adopted, was having her educated in some convent in Java, and spoke of her as "white daughter." He had sworn a mighty oath to marry her to a white man before he went home, and to leave her all his money. "And the Captain Lingard has lots of money," would say Mr. Vink solemnly, with his head on one side, "lots of money, more than Hudig." And after a pause, just to let his hearers recover from their astonishment at such an incredible assertion, he would add in an explanatory whisper, "You know, he has discovered a river." That was it. He had discovered a river. That was the fact placing old Lingard so much above the common crowd of sea-going adventurers who traded with Hudig in the daytime and drank champagne, gambled, sang noisy songs, and made love to half-caste girls under the broad veranda of the Sunda Hotel at night. Into that river, whose entrances himself only knew, Lingard used to take his assorted cargo of Manchester goods, brass gongs, rifles and gunpowder. His brick flesh, which he commanded himself, would on those occasions disappear quietly during the night from the roadstead. While his companions were sleeping off the effects of the midnight carouse, Lingard seeing them drunk under the table, before going on board, himself unaffected by any amount of liquor. Many tried to follow him, and find that land of plenty for gutta-percha and rattans, pearl shells and birds' nests, wax and gum dammer, but the little flesh could outsail every craft in those seas. A few of them came to grief on hidden sandbanks and coral reefs, losing their all and barely escaping with life from the cruel grip of this sunny and smiling sea. Others got discouraged, and for many years the green and peaceful-looking islands guarding the entrances to the promised land kept their secret with all the merciless serenity of tropical nature. And so Lingard came and went on his secret or open expeditions, becoming a hero in Almayer's eyes by the boldness and enormous profits of his ventures, seeming to Almayer a very great man indeed as he saw him marching up the warehouse, grunting a "How are you?" to Vink, or greeting Hudig, the master, with a boisterous "Hello, old pirate! Alive yet?" as a preliminary to transacting business behind the little green door. Often of an evening, in the silence of the then deserted warehouse, Almayer putting away his papers, before driving home with Mr. Vink, in whose household he lived, would pause listening to the noise of a hot discussion in the private office, would hear the deep and monotonous growl of the master, and the roared out interruptions of Lingard two mastiffs fighting over a marrowy bone. But to Almayer's ears it sounded like a quarrel of titans, a battle of the gods. After a year or so Lingard, having been brought often in contact with Almayer in the course of business, took a sudden, and, to the onlookers, a rather inexplicable fancy to the young man. He sang his praises, late at night, over a convivial glass to his cronies in the Sunda Hotel, and one fine morning electrified Vink by declaring that he must have had young fellow for a supercargo. Kind of captain's clerk. Do all my quill driving for me. Hudig consented. Almayer, with youth's natural craving for change, was nothing loth, and packing his few belongings, started in the flesh on one of those long cruises, when the old seaman was wont to visit almost every island in the archipelago. Months slipped by, and Lingard's friendship seemed to increase. Often pacing the deck with Almayer, when the faint night breeze, heavy with aromatic exhalations of the islands, shoved the brig gently along under the peaceful and sparkling sky, did the old seaman open his heart to his entranced listener. He spoke of his past life, of escaped dangers, of big profits in his trade, of new combinations that were in the future to bring profits bigger still. Often he had mentioned his daughter, the girl found in the pirate craw, speaking of her with a strange assumption of fatherly tenderness. She must be a big girl now, he used to say. "'Tis nigh unto 4 years, since I have seen her. Damn, Almayer, if I don't think we will run into Sourabaya this trip." And after such a declaration he always dived into his cabin muttering to himself, "Something must be done, must be done." More than once he would astonish Almayer by walking up to him rapidly, clearing his throat with a powerful M, as if he was going to say something, and then turning abruptly away, to lean over the bulwarks in silence, and watch, motionless for hours, the gleam and sparkle of the phosphorescent sea along the ship's side. It was the night, before arriving in Sourabaya, when one of those attempts at confidential communication succeeded. After clearing his throat he spoke to some purpose. He wanted Almayer to marry his adopted daughter. "Andy, don't you kick because you're white," he shouted, suddenly, not giving the surprised young man the time to say a word. "One of that with me. Nobody will see the color of your wife's skin. The dollars are too thick for that, I tell you. And mind you, they will be thicker, yet before I die. There will be millions, Casper. Millions, I say. And all for her and for you, if you do what you are told. Startled by the unexpected proposal, Almayer hesitated, and remained silent for a minute. He was gifted with a strong and active imagination, and in that short space of time he saw, as in a flash of dazzling light, great piles of shining guilders, and realized all the possibilities of an opulent existence. The consideration, the indolent ease of life for which he felt himself so well fitted his ships, his warehouses, his merchandise old lingered would not live forever, and, crowning all, in the far future gleamed like a fairy palace the big mansion in Amsterdam, that earthly paradise of his dreams, where, made king amongst men by old Lingard's money, he would pass the evening of his days in inexpressible splendor. As to the other side of the picture, the companionship for life of a Malay girl, that legacy of a boatful of pirates, there was only within him a confused consciousness of shame, that he a white man still, a convent education of 4 years. And then she may mercifully die. He was always lucky, and money is powerful. Go through it. Why not? He had a vague idea of shutting her up somewhere, anywhere, out of his gorgeous future. Easy enough to dispose of a Malay woman, a slave, after all, to his Eastern mind, convent or no convent, ceremony or no ceremony. He lifted his head, and confronted the anxious yet irate seaman. I of course anything you wish, Captain Lingard. Call me father, my boy. She does, said the mollified old adventurer. Am though, if I didn't think you were going to refuse. Mind you, Casper, I always get my way, so it would have been no use. But you are no fool. He remembered well that time the look, the accent, the words, the effect they produced on him, his very surroundings. He remembered the narrow slanting deck of the brig, the silent sleeping coast, the smooth black surface of the sea with a great bar of gold laid on it by the rising moon. He remembered it all, and he remembered his feelings of mad exultation at the thought of that fortune thrown into his hands. He was no fool then, and he was no fool now. Circumstances had been against him, the fortune was gone, but hope remained. He shivered in the night air, and suddenly became aware of the intense darkness which, on the sun's departure, had closed in upon the river, blotting out the outlines of the opposite shore. Only the fire of dry branches lit outside the stockade of the Raja's compound called fitfully into view the ragged trunks of the surrounding trees, putting a stain of glowing red halfway across the river, where the drifting logs were hurrying towards the sea through the impenetrable gloom. He had a hazy recollection of having been called some time during the evening by his wife. To his dinner probably. But a man busy contemplating the wreckage of his past in the dawn of new hopes, cannot be hungry whenever his rice is ready. Time he went home, though, it was getting late. He stepped cautiously on the loose planks towards the ladder. A lizard, disturbed by the noise, emitted a plaintive note and scurried through the long grass growing on the bank. Almayer descended the ladder carefully, now thoroughly recalled to the realities of life by the care necessary to prevent a fall on the uneven ground where the stones, decaying planks, and half-sawn beams were piled up in inextricable confusion. As he turned towards the house, where he lived, why old house he called it, his ear detected the splash of paddles away in the darkness of the river. He stood still in the path, attentive and surprised at anybody being on the river at this late hour during such a heavy freshet. Now he could hear the paddles distinctly, and even a rapidly exchanged word in low tones, the heavy breathing of men fighting with the current, and hugging the bank on which he stood. Quite close to, but it was too dark to distinguish anything under the overhanging bushes. Arabs, no doubt, muttered Almayer to himself, peering into the solid blackness. What are they up to now? Some of Abdullah's Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.